Okay, thanks. Well, as we're speaking at CERN right now, they're working hard. They work more or less around the clock. And there's websites at CERN.ch that tell you about how much work they're doing to get this collider commissioned. And they have a schedule and so on. And it's all supposed to start about now and be commissioned by about the fall. And then, of course, it will take some time for commissioning. And next year, it will plan to be running at full luminosity, full capacity, and so on. So I just wanted to describe at the very beginning the LHC. Now, the discussion today is going to be from a particle physics standpoint of our workshop, physics at the LHC. There's lots of interesting physics that's going on with ALICE. This is a detector for heavy ion collisions, and LHCb, which is measuring the properties of B quarks. We are mostly going to be interested in the physics associated with the CMS detector and the ATLAS detector. Now, let me just describe to you the LHC for a few minutes, okay? At the beginning of the outline here is the L stands for large, and I want you to have a sense of how large it is. So this is the LHC ring. This is located at CERN, just outside of Geneva, Switzerland. Part of this accelerator cuts into Switzerland, and part of the ring is in France. Voltaire lived here and sent nasty letters to people across Europe from there, in case you're familiar with Voltaire's story. So this is 27 kilometers in circumference. It's quite big. And the average depth of this accelerator ring is 100 meters. It's actually a little bit on an incline because the Jura Mountains are out here somewhere. And so they build it on an incline to reduce the amount of civil engineering costs. The accelerator is 14 TeV center of mass energy, which is 7 times higher than the Tevatron's energy, which is to date the highest energy proton accelerator in the world. What happens at the LHC? Let me describe it. First, hydrogen is produced from some standard hydrogen bottle source down at the bottom of the board somewhere. And then it's accelerated through a LINAC. The LINAC is, the protons are injected from this LINAC 2 into this booster at 50 MeV. That booster works its magic on the protons and the gets injected into this proton synchrotron, and they're accelerated another 1.4 GeV, actually up to 25 GeV. This is 1.4 GeV, comes into this proton synchrotron, gets accelerated up to 25 GeV, then gets kicked out up here into the SPS ring, which is a famous ring from CERN history, gets accelerated up to about 450 GeV in this SPS ring, and then in bunches, in proton bunches, they get injected into the LHC ring, this big 27-kilometer ring, through, and they go through this side and that side. They get peeled off so that they go around the colliders in opposite directions and opposite rings and then get focused at a point for a collision. Now, the LHC ring takes about 4.5 minutes to load. So all these protons come, they load in about a 4.5 minute time period, and then they're accelerated for 20 minutes. So nothing happens, no data is taken when things are running for about 20 minutes until they reach their 7 TeV energy. Each beam is 7 TeV, one going one direction, one going the other. And then at that end of that 20-minute mark, then the accelerator is ready to go, and you're ready to take the measurements. And the beam, these protons just travel around and around and around for 10 hours before the beam decays. Now, what do they look like? What do these protons look like as they're accelerating in the beam? Well, there's a bunch that's about 8 centimeters wide, and the bunches are separated by about 7 to 9 meters. So there's a bunch of protons, and then they're each about eight centimeters long, and they're separated by about 7 meters all throughout the ring. And in each bunch, there is 100 billion protons. And so 100 billion protons in one bunch, 8-centimeter bunch, collides with another 100 billion protons. They're sort of around the entire 27 kilometers. They're about one millimeter in diameter, the beam. And then they get focused to about 16 microns right at the collision point. So there's a super tiny area. Both of them get down to that 16 microns or so. And out of 100 billion protons colliding with another 100 billion protons, how many of them do you think interact? Close. 20. And out of those 20 interactions, each time they pass by each other, how many of them do most of us at this workshop care about? I have to phrase it carefully. How many at our workshop? Out of those 20?
Zero.
Zero. There you go. Zero. It's about 10 to the minus 8 is about the number. So it takes about 10 to the 8 collisions before you produce, say, a top quark pair, for example. So this is just an extraordinary feat of engineering. I mean, some of the features of this ring are mind-boggling. The 27 kilometers, that's the first thing you think about. 27 kilometers under Geneva. Wow. They don't even have to pass through passport control. So it's I'm jealous of those protons. 10 to the minus 13 atmospheres is the internal pressure. In the volume, which is roughly the size of a cathedral, so it's a huge volume around the ring, you got to get down to 10 to the minus 13 atmospheres. 40,000 leak-tight pipe junctions throughout the accelerator. The cool-down process takes several weeks. In fact, it's going on right now. There's been a cool-down on one sector. There's 8 sectors of this ring. One sector has been more or less completely cooled down. Other sectors are being cooled down over the coming months. It takes weeks to do it. You start with 10 tons of liquid nitrogen to bring it down to 80K. And then you make this refrigerator pump and pump and pump, and then you get down to 4.5 Kelvin. And then you fill the magnets up with 60 tons of liquid helium. And if you're a condensed matter physicist, you know that you're, you know, how precious liquid helium is. Imagine 60 tons of liquid helium that have to be pumped into there to get down to the operating temperature of 1.9 Kelvin. And throughout this ring, there's about 2,000 dipole magnets, accelerating dipole magnets. Each one is 14 meters long, 35 tons in length, an internal magnetic field of about an eight and a third Tesla. There's tremendous engineering involved and state-of-the-art engineering in addition to state-of-the-art physics. And as I say, you can track the progress of this on the website. Here's, I just hold up one piece of paper, what you might see on the website. Different sectors and their cool down process and when beams are supposed to be commissioned. Beam commissioning to 7TV is supposed to be starting in May. And that will take place over several months, and then by fall, certainly, there will be some collisions to talk about. Okay, so that concludes part one of the outline. L stands for large. I hope you get a sense of that. Large number of protons, a large accelerator, large energy. It's really something else. And if you get a chance to get to Geneva and see the detectors before they close up, do it, because it just makes your stomach sink to see to look down at this tremendous work.
Have the politicians and diplomats to visit this place, and then they will give us more
time. Yeah. All right. So what makes, why are we so excited about the LHC? And to begin with, I think if you had to make, say, one word, I would say confidence. And it's a confidence that we haven't had in particle physics discovery for a few decades, actually. Even though we've made great discoveries and have done excellent work in particle physics, the confidence of what we'll see at the next step, I think, is a lot higher now than it has been in a while. So you think about the history of particle physics in the 1970s, we find the tau lepton and the B quark. This is 1.8 GeV, 5 GeV. In the 1980s, as we scale up in energy, we're entering the frontiers of energy. We see the W mass, 80 GeV, the Z mass, 91 GeV. And then as we go even higher, the Tevatron in the 1990s, we see the top quark, 175 GeV. So we can have the right to be excited about just going higher in energy, right? I mean, you go higher in energy, you see more things. We have the right to be excited on that, okay? But there's more to it with the LHC than just going further in uncharted territory and seeing what happens. There's also this confidence. And this confidence is really associated with that of determining the origin of electroweak symmetry breaking and equivalently elementary particle mass generation. Now, since the 70s, as you've seen, we've been discovering particles. And these have been matter particles and force particles. These are gauge bosons associated with the weak force. These are matter particles. This is a heavy copy of the electron. This is a heavy copy of the down quark. This is a heavy copy of the up quark. So they're sort of copies of things that we know about that are very interesting, plus these force particles. But since the 70s, we've also been looking for another particle, and that's the Higgs boson. And we have more or less failed for 30 years to find this all-important particle. Now, you've probably heard the statement, the Higgs boson is the last particle of a standard model to be found. Okay? But I think that phrase belies the true interest in the Higgs boson, also the true interest in a whole sector of theory, which is the origin of elementary particle masses and electroweak symmetry breaking. It's not just a matter of finding one particle. It's really finding a whole new sector and explanation of what's going on in nature. So for a while, I'm going to talk about just the standard model Higgs boson, to give you a few statements about that. And you see that the third part of my talk is called, "But Nobody Believes That." And that refers to just simply the Higgs boson. Okay, so just give you a sense of where I'm going on that. So the Higgs boson is the postulated particle. It is a speculative particle, in fact. It is usually attributed to be the particle in the standard model that gives mass to everything. Okay. So its properties are that it's a Lorentz scalar. So right at bullet one, this is a weird object because there's no other known fundamental scalar in nature. All these others are fermions and spin one bosons. This is a spin zero particle right at bullet one, something very unusual about this postulated particle. Under the forces SU2 cross U1 hypercharge, this is the weak force and this is the hypercharge force, the Higgs is a doublet under the SU2 weak force and one half charge under hypercharge. And when it gets a vacuum expectation value, it breaks down to U1 electromagnetism. This particle, by doing this, it gives mass to all elementary particles. So this little Higgs boson gives mass to everybody. It's the little engine that could for the entire theory. And I have to interject a little personal note on this. I was a condensed matter theorist briefly. Condensed matter, I enjoyed it for all you condensed matter people. I really liked it a lot. However, I went to a colloquium sort of like this, and I saw this guy standing up there talking about the Higgs boson and this fundamental scalar that did everything. Got a vacuum expectation value, gave mass to the electron, to the tau, to the top, to the W, to the Z, to everything. And I just thought, oh, these particle physicists, they don't know what they're doing. I'm gonna go into particle physics and just clean up. But there's a lot of smart people in particle physics, I discovered pretty quickly, and they tried lots of different things. Things that are sort of the analogs to Cooper pairs, the analogs to all sorts of different things that are in condensed matter systems. But this has really survived an onslaught of theories. It is an excellent theory, and it is the standard benchmark theory for elementary particle mass generation that must be taken seriously. And if you are to build an accelerator that is to look for the origin of electroweak symmetry breaking and mass generation, you better cover this. Because if you don't cover this, it will be sort of a disaster on grand proportions to not be able to fully know whether or not this is at play in nature. It's an excellent theory that is compatible with data. So the way it gives mass is, just draw it diagrammatically, is by a vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. So a fermion mass is generated through a diagram like this, and a Yukawa coupling at this intersection, this interaction between the Higgs boson and the fermions. You put a vacuum expectation value on it, and you get that the fermion mass is a Yukawa coupling, a dimensionless Yukawa coupling, times the VEV. So the VEV of the field is V. Okay? So this is just very similar to Landau-Ginzburg type theory, which is the reason why I thought it had to be wrong, actually, was for that. So then the W mass is generated in a similar manner. You need two vacuum expectation values on it. This is a W mass squared interaction, and there's gauge coupling strengths squared at this vertex, and so the W mass is a gauge coupling strength squared times the VEV squared. So every particle has a different Yukawa coupling, and the gauge couplings multiplied by the VEV tell you what the W mass is. So we know what the VEV is of the Higgs. By virtue of the gauge sector, it is 246 GeV under some normalization. 246 GeV, so we know it. What we don't know, which is a very unfortunate thing, is we don't know its mass. The Higgs mass is twice times this coupling, lambda, which really is the interaction coupling of a four Higgs interaction in the potential. We don't know what that is a priori. There's nothing in the data that would tell us directly what this value is. Some theories connect this parameter with other parameters. Supersymmetry, for example, connects it with gauge couplings. But in the standard model, we don't know it. Unknown. The mass could be anything. So that's the first thing that you should be sad about today, is that we just have no idea what its mass is. And as I say, no collider has found it yet, even though we've been looking since the 70s. And the latest attempt that didn't work to find it, even though they did other excellent things that we will talk about in a few minutes related to the Higgs boson, but to find it directly they did not do at LEP. LEP 2, for example, which is an E plus E minus colliding machine. So E plus E minus come in. They produce an off-shell Z boson, which decays into a Higgs boson and a Z boson. So an on-shell Z boson, an on-shell Higgs boson. This Higgs, in the energy range that they have access to, decays into a BB bar pair. So two B quarks, that's what the Higgs wants to do. It's the heaviest states available to the Higgs to decay into. And this Z can decay into really anything and they'll be able to see it well. But just for the sake of our discussion, let's say it's E plus E minus pair, so an electron positron. So that can decay into that. So what do you do at the collider? You look for two leptons which reconstruct, the invariant mass of these two leptons reconstruct the Z mass. And then you look for, given that, you look for an additional BB bar pair in the data. So BB bar pair, you look for a bump on that. And if you see a BB bar pair with invariant mass that is lining up with some number, you don't know what it is a priori, but 100 GeV or something, then you found the Higgs boson. Now, the energy of this collision, the center of mass energy, got up to 209 GeV. You say, well, okay, I have 209 GeV at my disposal. What do I do with that? I can produce the Higgs boson. I know what the mass of the Z is. I don't know what the mass of the Higgs boson is. So the amount of energy I have available to me is going to be the Higgs boson mass plus the Z mass. If I produce them at rest with no kinetic energy, just at rest, this is the maximum I can get to find the Higgs boson. And that number, if you subtract this out, that number is 117, 118 or something GeV. Turns out that the mass limit from LEP is 114 GeV. I think maybe it's 114.4, but that's good enough. 114 GeV. So we know that the Higgs, the standard model theory, has to have a mass greater than that. So that puts us right here on this mass line. We know the Higgs has to be greater than that. Been trying since the 70s. The Higgs is more difficult to find than the top quark. That's the reason why its limit is not quite as good. Tevatron has essentially no limits on the standard model Higgs boson at all right now. So the LEP is the only one that we need to talk about at the moment. Okay, so Higgs has eluded many colliders. LHC's just another collider. That's just another one in the in the pipeline. So business as usual. Let's run it. See if we find it. If we don't find it, we'll build a bigger collider, right? Wrong. Too many people shook their head yes. I need to slow down. There's a lot of yeses on that. There's more to it at the LHC, and it's this confidence business that I'm telling you about, I mentioned earlier. We have confidence now, unlike previous accelerators, that we can find evidence certainly for the Higgs boson. And we can find evidence for even theories that don't match the standard model that can give electroweak symmetry breaking. So I should describe to you what that confidence is in the standard model, okay? Because that is the quintessential model of electroweak symmetry breaking. We cover that. We cover a lot. So I will first tell you the old answer to this confidence. It's the confidence that gave rise to the SSC. It's also the confidence that gave rise to approval, to some degree, of the LHC. The approval of the LHC happened in 1994, sort of final approval, I think was in 1994. So this is the old answer to why the LHC is so special. It is old, but it's still relevant. So it's not like we're going to discuss things that are irrelevant, but I'd give you a feel for how this developed historically. And it's to go to WW scattering. W's are interesting particles. They are one of the heaviest force-carrying particles that we know, W's and Z's. They have mass associated with them, and they have polarizations. And the longitudinal polarization of the W is a particularly interesting polarization because it's sensitive. Its interactions sort of grow at very high momentum. And a few of the diagrams associated with W scattering, well, I'll just write down the WW2WW scattering, are this. There's a sort of a four-point gauge boson interaction vertex. And then there's WW through photon and Z, WW on a T-channel, sort of vertical channel. And then, in this standard model theory, we have a Higgs boson diagrams as well for this WW scattering. Now, if I look at the amplitude of this, and I'm really interested in the amplitude when the energy of these incoming W's is much greater than the mass, because there's a special higher interaction that's happening when you go to very high energies. And when you do that, you find minus mh squared over v squared. This is just the amplitude over the center of mass energy squared plus this T is the Mandelstam variable, which you can just think of as the center of mass energy squared multiplied by an angular factor. So depending on what angle the W's come out on. All right, okay, so that's the amplitude. What do we do with this amplitude? Well, you go back to quantum mechanics and do a partial wave expansion of the cross-section, which is of the amplitude, 16 pi, expanded in terms of these infinite number of partial waves, 2L plus 1, Legendre polynomials AL. So this is the so-called partial wave amplitude in this decomposition of the amplitude. And whenever you do partial wave expansions, ultimately you're going to want to be looking at the optical theorem. That's what we're going to do shortly. The optical theorem is the forward amplitude is related directly to the total cross-section. So getting the total cross-section in this language is easy. You square it, you integrate over the angle of these W's, and there's an orthonormal set here, of course, so you get out an easy expression, and then you set that equal to the imaginary part of the forward scattering cross-section. Now, I'm going to skip some steps on that, but what you find out is that, let's see, how should I write this? What you find out is that the real part of any amplitude, partial wave amplitude, plus the imaginary part squared has to be equal to the imaginary part. So this is the total cross-section. The total cross-section is just going to depend on AL squared, sums of AL squared. And this is the imaginary part of the forward cross-section. Now, that's an easy equation from elementary school. And you just write it down. The real part, AL, imaginary part, AL. And you find that there's a limit on how large each partial wave can be. So the real part has to be less than or equal. The absolute value has to be less than one half for this partial wave expansion. Now, I take this amplitude and I just decompose it in terms of partial waves. And at the very first partial wave, you get an interesting result at AL equals zero.
Can you tell us again what the T is? The S is the center of mass energy. What's the little
T? Oh, yeah, this is actually T is P of an incoming W plus minus P of an outgoing W minus squared. And so ultimately, it's the center mass energy times a cosine factor, or times an angular factor, or 1 minus an angular factor. Okay. So you should just think of it as more or less the energy in the in it. Okay. So the zeroth partial wave, I just integrate the amplitude over it, and I find minus mh squared over 8 pi v squared. And this is in the limit. Now I really take this limit where s is much, much greater than mh. Okay? And that's the answer. But I just said that the real part has to be less than 1/2. So this result has to be less than 1/2. The absolute value of it has to be less than 1/2. So what I get is that mh is less than twice v times square root of pi. Remember, well, we all know what pi is, and we all know what v is now. V is just this 246. We were able to get that from the gauge sector, and of course we know what 2 is. So the combination of this is about 870 GeV. So this is a tree level perturbative unitarity result. You can go to higher order loop effects. You can look at other channels. You can do lots of different things with this. There's many papers written on this since the late 70s. Many papers written on this topic. And what you generally find is that there's an expectation due to unitarity considerations that the Higgs mass be less than about 800 GeV. Okay, the standard model Higgs theory is sort of meaningful and perturbative and so on. Yes, that's right. So this is, like I say, perturbative unitarity. Right, and in the Landau pole expression, yeah, as you say, in the Landau pole expression, you know that the renormalization group flow of this parameter, of the self-coupling parameter, is actually some number which I think might be 2 times lambda squared minus something like 3/4 yt to the 4th, etc. Lots of different terms. And when the mass of the Higgs boson gets much higher than any other scale, much higher than the top quark mass scale, then this term dominates. You have a very simple differential equation to solve with an exploding coupling, and you find that by doing that, is your Landau pole expression, you find about this result as well. So both of them are actually related to the expression. Okay, so the important point about that is that something's got to give at around 800 GeV. Okay, well, if 800 GeV was higher than the center of mass energy of most of the accelerators that we've been doing since the 1970s and 1980s, Tevatron was at 2 TeV center of mass energy for proton-on-proton collision. So you say, well, okay, 2 TeV, that's 2,000 GeV, that's higher than the 800 GeV. So why didn't the Tevatron find it, cover it up to that mass? Well, the problem is, first, the Higgs is very difficult to find. It's subtlety. In fact, the Tevatron probably has produced Higgs bosons, but we just can't find it. It's kind of an eerie thought, actually. If I were an experimentalist, I wouldn't be able to sleep because there's Higgs bosons that are out there and I can't find them. But there's more to it than that. When you go to higher energy, you have more kinematic accessibility to get all the way up to 800 GeV. And the important thing to remember is that a proton is not just an elementary particle. The proton has substructure to it. So the proton has 3 quarks. Let's up, up, down. and I have some 7 TeV energy associated with it, and each one of these quarks is what initiates an interaction. And so I say, well, okay, about 1/3 of the beam energy from each beam is sort of accessible. There's error and slop in that statement, about 1/3. So that's for each beam, and so I get something like, just a crude estimate is 1.5 TeV or something at the LHC. Okay, so at the LHC, I have enough energy to start to really cover this entire region of possibility from this perturbative unitarity Landau pole type of argument. But it gets even better than that, because even though experimentalists are losing sleep at night, they're not just losing sleep worrying, they're losing sleep by doing a lot of great work. And the great work that they've done in the last 10 years is related to precision electroweak analysis. And I'm fascinated by this whole topic, actually, precision electroweak. Doing experiments at such a precise level that quantum corrections are not only sort of an optional thing that you can employ, but you have to. Otherwise, you just don't get the right answer. And I want to demonstrate that to you. So the new answer, which really is a combination of very good theory and very good experiment, couldn't be done with experiment alone, it couldn't be done by theory alone. It's a combination of this in the last few years has changed the story dramatically, has even given hope to Tevatron finding the Higgs, has given hope to finding the Higgs in a light window. So LEP, SLC at SLAC, and Tevatron, and others to some degree, but these really are the big three in this discussion, they have made super precise measurements that are of high relevance to the Higgs boson. Other people have made super precise measurements that are not necessarily of high relevance to the Higgs boson, but today our discussion is that, so that's what we focus on. Now, I want to do a basic tree-level precision electroweak analysis. And it's important to keep in mind that this is measurements that we're talking about, not some, you know, parameters and theory space that were just sort of floating around and somehow numbers fell from the sky. These are real measurements. This is a measurement of electrons with photons at a minimum of Q squared going to zero alpha. And I put a hat on it because it's a measurement. Okay? The measurement is 137 point something. The Fermi constant is really a rewriting of tau decay. So you measure tau decay, you just rewrite it in a special form, and that's all this is a measurement. And it's these are known to great accuracy. 1.16 times 10 to the minus 5 GeV inverse squared. And then, of course, the Z-mass. They scanned the Z particle pole with E plus E minus collisions at both LEP and SLC. They got their diagram, their scan diagram, and then right there is the Z-mass, and that is measured very, very well also. These three numbers are a huge deal, measured exceptionally well. And now I'm going to input these using a tree-level theoretical analysis. And I'm going to predict what all the theory prediction of all the other observables based on this. And at tree level, I can do this for all the relevant precision electroweak observables. So, of course, if I want to write my theory prediction of alpha in alpha observable in terms of this. This is a very trivial function, right? It's just equal to alpha. And the same for GF and the same for MZ. However, if I want to write my theory prediction for something more complicated, like the W mass, I have to do some work. And I won't do the work here, but it's not too hard. So this is a theory prediction for the W mass is pi square root of 2 GF inverse alpha 1 minus 4 pi alpha hat. This is all written in terms of observables. That's it. MW squared? Yeah, this should be squared. Okay, so what this does is this tells me, if I were to plug in all these observables, this tells me that MW, the theory prediction for it, is 80.94 GeV. Okay? Now, I do the same thing for another extremely important observable, which is sine squared theta effective leptons. And that tells you angular correlations in the decays of a Z boson into leptons. It's related to that, this angle. Okay? I can make that prediction, and it's a complicated expression. And then the answer is 0.21215. And then the other very interesting, relevant observable for precision electro week is the partial width of Z decays into leptons. Okay, so if you know the full width, the partial width is just the branching fraction of this into of the Z into leptons times the full width. Okay, so this I can do, and it's a complicated expression, and I get 84.843 MeV. Now, all that work and experiment, what did they come up with? What they came up with is not that. I'll give you a hint. I guess you expected that. Experiment. Oops, let me write it here. Experiment gave 80.426 plus or minus 0.034 GeV. This is a biggie. 0.23150 plus or minus 0.00016. Just incredible precision on this. And the leptonic partial width experiment was 83.984.086 MeV. Now, These two, this is even more off, but these two are greater than 10 sigma off. More than 10 sigma. If you try to do just simple tree level analysis, you're wrong, and you're wrong by a lot. So you got to do better. And the literature...
Have you put the running of alpha at your tree level?
I didn't, no. That's right, yeah. So if I included the running of alpha, things get a little bit better, but this is still really quite far off. So I need to include loop corrections, loop quantum corrections. And when you hear the words loop quantum corrections, generally how you should think of it is that everything depends on everything. But you just got to get it right. You have to get the factors right, but everything depends on everything. Sure enough, let's just look at the W mass. If I do the shift in the loop corrections on the W mass, then I have to do loops where things come in around themselves and connect up in these diagrams. And, well, a famous loop is a top-bottom, so suddenly the top quark is relevant. Even though we're at somewhat lower energies, the top quark is relevant to all this. It comes in these loop corrections. And so does the Higgs. And there's diagrams with the Higgs involved. There's more diagrams. So, even though we haven't produced the Higgs in real terms directly, we are producing and sensitive to the Higgs boson through these quantum corrections and these loops. Now, the great thing about what these experiments have done is that they've measured all this, but they've also measured at Tevatron the top quark mass really well. Top quark mass is 173.5 plus or minus 5.4 GeV. Known very well. Actually, it's one of the best known quarks in all of the standard model as far as relative fraction error. So what we find is we have to make a new plot for precision electroweak sensitivities on these observables on the Higgs mass. And this is one of my favorite plots in Particle Data Group makes it. But any of you can make it with a little effort. So I make my students make this plot, and they're happy for a week. So if you want to be happy, make this plot. All right. So the measurements are inside this circle, 68%. Confidence level. Okay, so the numbers don't matter. I'd be sitting here all day with little tick marks trying to make the numbers, but there is a range which you've measured for the leptonic partial width, and there's a range that you've measured for sine squared theta, and you get this oval at the 68% confidence level. Now you want to know, what is a theory prediction? I have these inputs, and I've done all my loop stuff. I've worked really hard, and you get this about here when the Higgs mass is 100 GeV. And you know everything else, more or less. So you get about that. Now, let's say the Higgs mass is 800 GeV. You get that. Way up there, you get that. And so you can draw, if you keep on doing the calculations and have this as a free parameter. So this is a Higgs mass as a free parameter. You get something that looks like that. And actually, there's some thickness to it. The thickness is related to several uncertainties in the precision electroweak, including the top quark mass, including exactly how you run alpha from the low scale to the high scale, the delta alpha hadrons corrections. How do you take into account hadrons at really low momentum squared? So that's a sort of a tricky part. But the pattern is clear. The pattern is very clear. And the recent work of the precision electroweak folks is that the Higgs mass is less than 182 GeV at 95% confidence level. That is the mass, which is well below any, you know, Landau-Pohl perturbative unitarity constraint, etc. This is quite a significant. And in fact, at 800 GeV is about 9 sigma off, when you take into account all the current data. So it's a spectacular, in my view, achievement by experiment to really push the range of the Higgs mass. So the Higgs mass, 15 years ago or so, was this wild parameter. We have no idea what it was. Now we know it's between 114 GeV and this is a little bit fuzzier, 182 GeV at 95% confidence level. It could be higher, of course. So it's a little bit fuzzy, but it is very much narrowed down to compared to what it used to be.
It assumes that there is only one Higgs.
This assumes there's only one Higgs. That's right. This is a standard model. So. Let me just tell you one way they find the Higgs boson, and then I will go to the next section, which is but nobody believes that, okay? Which you probably are one, maybe. Okay, so here's one way to find the Higgs. There's actually I have six diagrams. There's six different key diagrams to find the Higgs boson in this range, but one of them, which has gotten a lot of attention over the years, is looking at the Higgs boson being produced through gluons from the proton. You peel off gluons from the proton, you make a Higgs boson, and then through a W and T loop, it decays into two photons. And there's a rather large background to that. The signal of invariant mass of two photon, and it goes like this. That's the signal. Actually, I've drawn the signal much bigger than it actually will be at the collider. This is a very difficult process to find, but they're getting a very good invariant mass resolution on the photon. This Higgs is only several MeV in width, sort of, and the better invariant mass resolution you have at the detector, the more you can cut out extraneous background and find a peaking signal. So a lot of effort in the detectors have been to get this going at very good invariant mass resolution. All right. So nobody believes that. Well, maybe a few. Actually, I've met a few. They sort of appear in the night and then go away. But I've met a few that believe in it. But the Higgs boson is actually a very delicate creature. I call it an NBA player because it needs a sort of an entourage to be successful, and it's very sensitive to quantum corrections. It's a fundamental scalar, and if you put any heavy particle in there that connects in any way to the Higgs boson, then it has a quantum correction which goes like the mass of that very heavy thing. But if you're quadratically sensitive to heavy scales, then it's very difficult to keep the mass in the scale of the Higgs boson down in this region of 90 GeV and 80 GeV. And so theoretically, it looks awful to have just a standard model Higgs boson. It might be true. There might be fine tunings in nature, but it just looks bad. And there's several other reasons to not be particularly happy about the Higgs boson. It's one boson does everything, which we talked about before. And this quadratic sensitivity, it doesn't connect. It doesn't have its symmetry breaking built into it. It's a little bit like the Landau-Ginzburg models. There's something more behind them, usually, than just treating it as fundamental. And so there's different theories. And I'm a little bit behind schedule of what I was going to do, but let me just tell you about some of the things that we're working on in this workshop to give you a feeling for why we're here. So you might say, well, okay, this is an interesting story, and there's probably more to the Higgs boson, but why are people here? And I'll give you just one example of that, and then I'll go to sort of semi-philosophical discussion there. Okay, so soon we will have in our workshop a discussion on how to identify top quarks at very high momentum. Okay, so if you produce a top quark at low momentum, then it comes out, it's sort of slow, it looks around, and then it decays in one way, it got the W, and another way it goes a B. And they're sort of going all over the place in their decay products because it's just a lounging about particle. But if you produce it from some really heavy resonance decaying, and then the top quark come out highly boosted, really energetic, then the decay products are going to want to go in the same direction as it. And so, okay, why do we care about that? If we had no sense of any theoretical physics, we would say, well, that's just one out of 300,000 interesting things to try to measure is having a really heavy top quark. But this has relevance for physics that we think is possible for the entourage of the Higgs boson, a way to make the Higgs boson natural and not suffer from these tremendous quantum corrections. And it starts with postulating that the universe has some warp geometry, like the Randall-Sundrum approach. And it's very simple. St- start is at, this is an extra dimension. This is a brain, three-dimensional brain, and this is an extra dimension y right here. And at y equals 0 is one brain, which we can call the Planck brain. And at the other brain, we can call this y equals pi r here. The geometry is a slice of ADS5. You can pack phi the extra dimension on a circle modulo z2. Okay. Now, I'm going to just sketch a few features of this that are important. Okay. One feature is that if you put the fermions in the bulk here, so the standard model fermions, the top quark, the tau lepton, and so on, the profile of those fermions in this bulk will help determine its mass. So the wave function, if the wave function is peaking more towards this IR brain, which is where the standard model, where we live, our three-dimensional brain, then it will have more mass. And if it peaks over here, then the wave function has very little support on this brain and has a much smaller mass. Okay. Now, it just so happens that the wave function of the first Kaluza-Klein excitation of the gluon is highly peaked. So let's call this a gluon first Kaluza-Klein excitation. First Kaluza-Klein excitation is nothing more than putting the gluon in a box and seeing that there's higher momentum modes in these extra dimensions, and those higher momentum modes manifest themselves as masses in our world. Okay? So there's some heavy gluon. It wants to couple more to heavy states than it wants to couple to light states. And so you produce, you have to produce the gluon somehow, and then it wants to decay preferentially to top quarks. So Lian Tao Wang and I think Jesse Thaler is working on this right now. I'm not sure if others are in the workshop or are also working on it, but there's a lot of interest from different people looking at how to discover this Kaluza-Klein excitation. Now, indirectly through the electroweak sector, through other Kaluza-Klein excitations, we know that this mass probably has to be greater than a TeV or two. Now, it's model dependent, but it probably needs to be greater than a TeV. So this is a heavy object that gets produced. Oop, you hit, you produce a really heavy object, and then it decays. And these top quark mass is much lighter than the Kaluza-Klein excitation of the gluon, this force carrier. And so this comes out at extremely high energy, top quark, and then it comes like this, sort of collimated decays with the W and the B quark. Now, normally, an experimentalist says this can't be identified very easily as a top quark, because normally you say, well, I'm going to identify the top quark by virtue of seeing a B quark over here in some B quark jet, and then over here I tag a lepton, and this lepton is isolated, meaning there's very little hadronic activity in some cone around it. So this no longer works, and you have to think of ways to identify the existence of a top quark at really high invariant mass. Okay? So that's example number one of the kinds of things that we're working on here, trying to figure out how to do this. Example number two, which we will have a workshop, discussion on by Matt Reese this week, I think, is how to determine the absolute mass scale of supersymmetry particles. So if I'll just give you one example of a supersymmetry decay. This is supersymmetry is an alternative theory that makes the Higgs boson viable by symmetries and canceling quadratic divergences. And I'm sure you will find some talk about that. squark, squark. This is a super part, scalar superpartners of the quarks. Decay into quark and a neutralino. Don't worry if you don't know what these particles mean right now. I'm just getting to the topology of it, what the final state looks like. Superpartners have their own sort of quantum number associated with that in most forms of supersymmetry, and so the lightest one is stable. So in this decay chain, the lightest one is stable. It is missing energy. And on each side, you get a couple of leptons and a quark. Now, the difficulty is, how do you know what the mass of the state is when it's escaping all detection? How do you know the mass? And there's many clever papers in the last year and a half that discuss exactly this this feature of how to get the absolute mass. It's been known for a long time and worked out how to get the relative mass, the mass difference between this guy, for example, and this guy in some decay chain. But the absolute mass has not been known. So we'll have a discussion about that as well. Okay, so lastly, I want to tell you just a little bit about how what I think the changes are in store for us in the LHC era. Okay, so just a couple of minutes on that. So we, as theorists, if most of us are theorists here. You know that even though it can be inspiring to ask what's possible, it's not particularly disciplining to ask what's possible, because there's a whole lot more that's possible than it's probable, right? And so if you just sit around and say, oh, what's possible in the world, you can really spin out of control pretty easily. And there's great examples of that, I think, in the literature, people spinning out of control. And so actually we've invented we've applied somewhat of an inventor's mentality to particle physics, and I think in theoretical physics in general. I saw on C-SPAN one day this inventor, I think it was the inventor of the Segway, and he said, well, how do you come up with all your great ideas? You're just incredible. He says, oh, it's very simple. All I do is I ask myself, what sucks? And then I find an answer to it, okay? And that's sort of what we do in particle physics, right? What sucks? Yeah, the Higgs boson. The flavor. I mean, we can't explain flavor, right? Supersymmetry breaking. We sort of ask ourselves that question, and then that disciplines us. That is actually a disciplining question to the what's possible. However, what's possible has, I think, a different, an alternative discipline in the LHC era, because what now we can ask ourselves, what's possible that can be seen at the LHC? Instead of just restricting ourselves, what's possible that solves our problems? Okay? And there are numerous examples of this disciplinary force, I think, that are starting to arise in the literature, starting to rise in particle physics because of the power of the LHC and how many things could happen and how difficult the LHC experiment is. You sort of have to know the answer before you get it, before you can see it. And so asking this disciplinary question, what's possible with what can the LHC do, gives you some insights into some additional interpretive power over the data. And just one example of that real quick is I asked myself, what's possible? A new particle, right? It's very human-centric to think that the only particles that exist in nature are sort of our bodies and copies of it and things that interact very directly to it. It's very human-centric to think that way. So, yeah, there could be lots of other things that connect to that are beyond us. Now, how could they possibly be seen through experiment? Because if they can't be seen through experiment, then I'm not sure if I really want to study it too much more. And so we have several of us in this workshop that are interested in exactly this question, what's possible that can be seen at the LHC? And a real window of opportunity for us is the Higgs boson, actually. So now we're going to go full circle and say the Higgs boson is sort of more or less right. There is a Higgs boson. There's an entourage that supports it, but there is a Higgs boson. What more can you do with it? What is the most special thing you can say about the Higgs boson? The most special thing, in my view, is that it is the only field that participates in a relevant gauge invariant, Lorentz invariant operator, the entire standard model. There's the hypercharge is irrelevant. You can write down a gauge invariant operator that's relevant, but it's not Lorentz invariant. But you can for the Higgs boson. And instead of having 1 over lambdas, big scales that you don't have any control over of how standard model particles might interact with a new world, a new sector, you have this. It's relevant. I can attach something else relevant. So I can attach a very weird sector to it, for example. And this is how fragile the Higgs boson is. You attach anything to this relevant operator, and everything changes. Almost everything changes. And most particularly, the LHC phenomenology changes. It's going to decay invisibly. It's going to decay through cascades into a bunch of soft stuff. It's going to decay lots of different possibilities. So the Higgs boson is not just the last particle to finish up the standard model. It really is sort of a whole new world and a whole new sector. And it's a lot of what we wish to cover in this workshop as well. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
If you discovered the only volcanic habitat, will that affect the precision electron weak estimates on the upper bound or the
It could. Generally speaking, in the supersymmetric theories, which is an excellent theory for a dark matter candidate, the precision electroweak is not affected much, which is one of the successes of supersymmetry, is that it decouples so rapidly that it doesn't affect it much. Here's another example of dark matter, right here. A real scalar, the end. That's a dark matter candidate. And this actually can affect precision electroweak a little bit through sort of mixings. I have the diagrams on the board erased, but sort of mixings of Higgs bosons. If this doesn't have a vacuum expectation value, then it won't even affect that. But if this has a vacuum expectation value, it will affect it. So it may or may not, but the general expectation is not too much for the simple versions.
So you mentioned whittling down what we think is possible, but notice you didn't mention another thing that has happened often in history is that we've found new things that are possible we hadn't thought of.
Yes, right. So I hope that's true, but I also hope it's true that we find things that we've been anticipating. Because electroweak symmetry breaking is truly around the corner physics for the last couple of decades. It's truly around the corner physics. If the answer to that is totally unique and has nothing to do with what we've discussed before, then I'm not sure what I will do in that circumstance, but I probably won't be looking for models of the next around the corner theory in that case. So I expect, I really expect that there'll be overlap with what we've done in the last two decades with what we find.
Okay, that's time to do it.